Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So it's nice to see so many of you here today on a cold, rainy, snowy day. Typical alpine weather, as we used to say. And thanks to all of you who came yesterday for the Great Compassion Vigil. We actually, in the monastery, we pray for peace in all the world every day. But it seemed good to open our doors to the wider community and invite people to join us in offering prayers for the world and the suffering of the beings who inhabit it. So again, thank you for those who came. So today we had the Festival of Great Compassion, Avalokiteshvara. I'm going to talk about the precepts, but it's directly related to compassion. Actually, compassion and the precepts don't stand against each other, or even apart from each other. Compassion is the precepts. You know, abiding by the precepts is compassion. The particular set of precepts that we follow are even called the Bodhisattva precepts. They're the precepts that one takes on the path of compassion. It's the dedication, commitment to help all beings cross to the other shore. We're in this not just for ourselves, but for everyone. And compassion means something like feeling with. We identify, we sympathize, we understand, we know those around us and what's going on around us. If we're keeping the precepts and meditating, we can't help but feel that. And then there is a response. It's both sensitivity to and a response to suffering. I want us to look at the precepts from two different angles or two windows. Again, keeping in mind that underlying this is compassion. The first one is no self. Right? And it really means no separate self. This is one of the crucial teachings of the Buddha and what set his teachings apart from the other teachings of his day, and from what I read somewhere, said from other world religions. Buddhism is the only one that emphasizes this no self, no separate self. And it's crucial because it ties in with the law of karma, it ties in with the law of impermanence, flux, it ties in with suffering, with dukkha. I got going on this because recently, in the past few months, I've been giving the precepts to, or explaining the precepts to different people, and explaining the precept on pride, on not being proud of oneself and devaluing others. I was reminded of talks that other monks have given here on the conceit of I am. It's easy to think that the precept to not be proud of yourself and devalue others is just about feeling superior to others. there's a list that I found in a short work by Nagarjuna. And he, instead of using the word pride, he uses the word arrogance, which is interesting. Okay, and he gets seven different kinds of arrogance. And the word arrogance itself is interesting because it comes from the verb arrogate, which means to attribute unjustifiably or without cause. Okay? And so it's not just about looking down on others, thinking one is, I'm better than. It's also, I'm inferior to. That's a form of arrogance. Okay? That's a form of pride. Also, I'm just the same as. And that, again, is a form of arrogance because we're imputing that there's a self, that there's something actually here, that these five skandhas are something, and that out there is something. And I'm relating to things as if they're actual these separate objects. Okay? But interesting enough, Nagarjuna, among the seven, he makes this very point. He says, as regards the five appropriated aggregates, the aggregates are the five skandhas. We refer to those in the scripture of great wisdom, sensation, thought, activity, consciousness. Those are the five, if you will, kind of almost streams that of physical and mental energy, spiritual energy that wind together and make up a human being. They aggregate, they clump together. And that's why we tend to view it as a self. This isn't a physiological description. Okay, it's just how the Buddha discovered the mind works. Okay, and that's what he saw as the inherent problem in suffering, is that we see a self. And then because we think we're separate, we suffer. We lose our connection. We lose our relationship to the world around us. Okay? You know, there's stories told about babies who, if sadly, don't receive any affection in the first part of their lives. And they end up almost mute. You know, they're deformed mentally. They can't relate to other beings. So this idea, that this setting up of a self, is a form of arrogance because we're imputing that to ourself. Okay. Nagarjuna puts it, as regards the five appropriated aggregates, they are empty of inherent existence and devoid of any person, in quotation marks. When, because of delusion, one imputes existence of self therein, this is known as self-imputing arrogance. I just found that yesterday. So. But I've been planning to talk about this for a while, so it was a real find. Okay. So when I was trying to explain the precept in this particular situation, again, it led me back to the conceit of I am. If we deal with the conceit of I am, then we deal with the problem I am better than, I am worse than, I am the same as. We take it back to the source of where the issue really begins. The word conceit itself originally comes from the word conceive. It's a conception. It's an idea. Again, we have an idea that we're a self. Okay? That's just an idea. It can be a very useful idea, and if we didn't have it, I don't know how we'd have driver's license and passports and be able to communicate with each other. It's a useful conception. It's a useful way of looking at things. But the Buddha taught us that there is another way of looking at things. Okay. There's another way of seeing the world without self. And when we do that, we're seeing a flow that includes ourselves, includes all things. If there's no separation, where is any boundary? Where is any line? What's separating me from you? What's separating us from the door and the building and the people in Syria? Meditation dissolves that barrier, that separation. It doesn't say that there isn't a conventional self. Sometimes that's what's called relative truth. It says there's an and there's what can be called absolute truth or perfect truth. Seeing our true nature and seeing the true nature of all beings, because that true nature is not separate. There's not a God out there somewhere that's separate, that is the source of the divine. There's not a soul in here, in my body, that is a concrete thing that doesn't change. It's actually a very wonderful thing that there's no self, because that means we can change. We're not stuck. We're not caught with forever and ever having this soul and having to, you know, haul that around. Okay? We can change. We can develop. We can move. We often talk about this, at least in our tradition, as the all is one and the all is different. Our Sando Kai, our scripture in the morning for morning office, is specifically about this. Where Master Jiyu once said that the title could be translated as seeing the all is one and the all is different, and seeing the all is different and the all is one. That's quite a mouthful. Okay. But she also said one time that seeing the all is one and seeing the all is different simultaneously, that's what enlightenment is. They're not opposites. And that doesn't compute in our minds. If you try to think that out, it doesn't, where do you go? But through meditation, you can know that. All right? You can know that identity with Buddha nature, if you want to call it that. And so then as I looked at this precept and looking at pride and then tracing it back to the I am better than, I am worse than, I am the same as, and then tracing it back to the I am, tracing it back to the I. I realized this applied to the other precepts too. You know, probably that's an obvious thing that everyone got long ago, but for some reason it took a long time for the penny to drop. Okay. And what came to mind first was the offertory that's recited when we take the precepts. The very end, it reads, to have attained such a relationship, quite previously to that, we're told that we're making the Buddha our teacher and the Bodhisattvas our friends. To have attained to such a relationship and possess such a pure body is surely to have attained the world of the precepts. Is this not so? To whom do we offer this merit? To where do we offer it? The offering, the donor, and they who receive these three things are completely immaculate. There is nothing to be desired. Let us, together with all living things, offer this common merit to the highest truth. Right there you have the essential teaching that there is nothing to offer to. There is no one who offers. Okay. There is no offering. The act of offering itself is empty. And then I took that and I said, oh, well, that's the way that precept works, the precept on not being stingy, the precept on admonishing generosity. There's no one to give. There's nothing to receive. There's nothing to give. There's no one to give. And I can see, oh, this is pointing back to the same thing within pride. If you let go of the I, then you can keep that precept perfectly. Okay. It doesn't mean that giving doesn't happen. But we don't crystallize an I'm giving to so-and-so. Okay? And breaking up reality into these little bits. We can give from a place of no self. And that's what we're aiming to do. And it's not that mysterious. The word no self, people often stumble over. Think of it as unselfishness. Okay? We all know what it is to be selfish. Okay, we know that. Okay? So what is unselfishness? Okay. Can we give from a place of unselfishness? So see, we already know how to keep that precept. We already know that in our blood and bones, in our skanda, because we know how that is. Okay? We know what it feels like when someone is selfish to us. Okay? So we endeavor not to be selfish in return. And then I started looking at the other precepts. And I realized that every one of them is pointing us to maintain the sense of unity, okay, of staying true to our Buddha nature, of not dividing the world up into this and that. These precepts are also often called the precepts of Buddha nature, because they're pointing to how to hard to maintain, uphold, what is, if there is no specific Buddha nature, what is it we're protecting or holding? But we know there's something. Okay. There's something that's not a thing. There's something we are responsible for. But if you look at each precept, you can see how it's showing us not to get into duality, not to separate things out, because it's based on that separation then that we break a precept. If we take the example of do not kill, okay, if you don't see the Buddha nature of something else or someone else, if you don't see their worth, if you don't respect them, it's very easy to take that next step and just disregard them. Or if they're in your way, let's get rid of them. And that's why that precept reads something like, do not kill, there is nothing to be killed. So you can take each precept like that if you look at it, you know, not to kill, not to steal. We already have everything. So why should we grab a piece of it that somebody else is being a steward of? Okay. Do not covet. There's nothing to desire. Why? If you work back into the place of no self, there is no one to desire. Okay. And again, this is not, what do they say? This is not a chemical equation. This is something that we can know in our own experience. And we have to practice to come from that place of Buddha nature. We have to practice keeping the precepts as we go about our daily life. There's meditation and there's the precepts. Because the precepts show us how we tend to not live from our Buddha nature. They're showing us it's not so good to do these sorts of things. They're not commandments. You know, there's no one going to punish us if we don't keep them. There's the law of karma. Now, that's another piece of this. If we don't keep the precepts, we learn, again, through our own meditation, through our own experience, that this causes suffering. This causes pain. So we resolve, I'm going to endeavor not to kill. We can kill some more than just people, animals, insects. We can kill someone's reputation. We can kill someone's joy. We actually can't live without killing something because we have to eat. And we acknowledge that. We're not trying to be breatharians. We're not trying to be pure. Okay, we have to kill microbes when we wash. Thankfully, we have white blood cells that kill diseases in our body. Okay. But we try to do as little killing as possible. And if we can keep in mind that that which appears to us is part of ourselves, it's much harder to decide to take its life. Do you understand what I'm getting at? You know, it's a way of keeping the precepts. To come back to the fundamental problem is we have an idea of a self that's separate from everything else. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't use our minds. It doesn't mean that we don't use the discriminative mind. But it doesn't control our lives. Okay? It's not all there is. Where Master Ji used to say that the mind is the brain. It's a wonderful computer. Okay? It's wonderful programs. But we don't let it make the decisions. Okay? It's to offer us choices. And the heart, the Buddha nature, is what makes the choice. I think we sit at our computer and we get really annoyed if it starts doing things that we don't want it to, that we didn't tell it to. Or where did that come from? Yeah. It's, you know, the operator, the person sitting here is what's telling, that makes the decisions of which program to run and what to do with it, da-da-da-da. There's many science fiction stories, I think, of computers, you know, kind of taking over the world because, you know, they become the decision makers. Okay. Well, I don't think it's that dramatic, but think about it. Don't think too much about it, but meditate on it. That's the word think. There's a lot of different meanings. Reflect on it. And when we have a decision to make, the precepts provide sort of a guide to how we can stay true to the heart, how we can stay true to our true nature, which is not separate from the true nature in the big sense. Okay. Reverend Master Ji used to, again, in order to talk about this, she used to call the... our individual Buddha nature, and then that which is greater she would talk about as the cosmic Buddha. But then she would quickly say, now, they're not separate, because it's hard to talk about, because they actually aren't separate, but in order to talk about it, we have to use words. Words are based on concepts. Okay. We have to use concepts, and that's okay. But we learn to use them as wisely as possible. And we learn to allow the decisions to be made from a deeper place. All right? So anyway, so this wasn't an awakening, but it was just a very startling to me understanding of all of a sudden I knew what Dogen was talking about in his Kyoju Kaimon. Now, I'm not going to read through that, but each of you can read through that. It's his short little commentary in the precepts. I'll just give you one example. I'll just read one we haven't talked about so that you just, again, kind of get another sense of how we're trying to look at our world, our universe, how things really are. We've talked about many of them. Here's one we haven't. Do not speak against others. Do not speak against the Lord of the house. Every person, every being is the temple of the Lord, wherein the Lord dwells, the still water wherein the dragon lives. If you speak against others, you speak against the Lord of the house. Do not try to divide the Lord of the house. Do not try to cause war within the Lord. Do not try to make the Lord make war upon himself. That was for Master Jiyu's commentary right there. And then we have Dogen's little commentary in the middle of that. In Buddhism, the truth and everything are the same. The same law, the same enlightenment, and the same behavior. Do not allow anyone to speak of another's faults. Do not find fault with the Lord of the house. Do not allow anyone to make a mistake in Buddhism. Okay. So again, the idea that the Lord of the house is another way of just talking about that which is greater than ourselves. I think it's a translation. I've seen another phrase that I think it's a comparable phrase is the old man in the castle. In Japan, in medieval Japanese, you know, the noble in the castle, he was really the Lord, and you didn't go against the Lord at the sake of risk of your own life. Okay? The Lord of the house, the old man in the castle. That which is greater than us, that we can take refuge in and that we can live from. The other, so that's looking at the precepts from the window, if you will, of no self. The other window is gratitude. Okay. This came about in talking with another monk, and we were talking about how dependent we are on electricity. And we were talking specifically about healthcare. Yeah. What happened to the world if all of a sudden we had no electricity? Look how much of our hospital, our surgery, doctor's office, everything related to healthcare now is run by electricity. If you go to your doctor, they don't have paper files anymore. They just pull you up on a computer. What would happen if we didn't have that? Okay. So it was a way of just pointing to how dependent we are on that. And then moving from that point to, well, isn't it important not to take it for granted? We have no right to all of this. Okay, we have no right to it. It's easy to think one does, but in actual fact, one doesn't. Okay. And then we move from that to not only don't take it for granted, but be grateful. Okay. Be grateful. And then we began discussing about how gratitude, my friend I was talking with, described gratitude as a shield, as something to protect us. Okay, protect us from not taking things for granted. To protect us from seeing the world in a dualistic way. Okay. And then what came to my mind was, well, actually, if you're in the state of gratitude, you can't help but keep the precepts. Think about it. If you're being grateful, it's hard to kill something. If you're being grateful, it's hard to speak against your neighbor or your coworker. It's another window into the precepts. It points to something very important about gratitude. Great Master Dogen, the Shishogi, he lists the four wisdoms, the signs of a bodhisattva: compassion, tenderness, benevolence, sympathy. And then it has a whole section on gratitude. Where Master Ji used to say, gratitude is the fifth wisdom. Look at, try it out for yourself. Cultivate gratitude. And look at your experience, look at your responses to the world, look at your interactions from the place of the precepts. And see how gratitude is that almost, you know, a shield or something that keeps, I don't want to say keep us in line with the precepts, but creates an atmosphere, an environment, a state of mind in which we don't want to break the precepts. Okay, why would we hurt ourselves? Okay, why would we go against our true nature? And gratitude can be as simple as, we're grateful to have a human body. We're grateful to encounter the Dharma. Those are considered the two greatest gifts. Now, all of us here sitting here, we already have the two greatest gifts. You know, can we be grateful for that, even if everything else is taken away? And then just begin to think about gratitude and have a gratitude for a chair, you know, for the carpet, for the building, to have a warm place. Hopefully most of us have enough food. Okay. Hopefully all of us have access to medical care. Okay. Look at how connected we are to the world and develop gratitude for that, for the simplest things. There's an old Christian hymn that goes, count your many blessings, name them one by one. Count your many blessings, see what the Lord has done. I was raised in that, so sometimes these old songs come to mind. I say, oh, that's what they were talking about. I can make use of that. Nothing is wasted. You know, so that little line comes to mind. And I find, yes, if I just start being grateful, if I just start having a bad mood or not feeling well, or if I can just start counting my blessings, starting with just as simple as, I'm glad I have a bed. I'm glad I have sheets on the bed. I'm glad I can wash my sheets occasionally. I'm glad. You know, where did these sheets come from? Someone made these sheets. Someone gave them to me. It's very much the what we're emphasizing in the first thought of the five thoughts in a mealtime. We must think deeply of the ways and means by which these things have come. And we reflect on the ways and means by which everything has come. I usually find that I don't have to go too far down the list that all of a sudden I'm in a better mood. Or I'm not feeling so bad anymore. Cultivating the attitude of gratitude. Okay. When we're in that attitude, when we're in that state of mind, we naturally keep the precepts. We naturally are being compassionate. We naturally don't want to kill. We naturally don't want to steal. We naturally don't want to speak against other people or run them down. So I'll close there. Those are just kind of two windows into the precepts, looking at it from the place of no self, no separate self, and then also looking at them from through the window of gratitude. And see how they're all a part of compassion. They don't stand apart from compassion. So again, it shows us how to emulate, how to copy, how to actualize Avalokiteshvara, Kanzan, great compassion. It gives us a way to be her, allow her to work through us. Okay? When we keep the precepts, when we're grateful, it's much easier to hear that inner voice, that inner sense of what is good to do. We call on Kanzan for help. It's much easier for us to see the help that's being given or be patient until it comes. Okay. So that's what I leave you with today is the importance of precepts in developing compassion, looking at them to the point of your no separate self and gratitude. So, thank you.